From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour takes us to the halls of Congress, and in fact, it takes it to you, the listener, a chance to hear from your members of Congress. It's something that on the first day of this program, we committed to bringing to you, and we opened that first day with an interview with Congresswoman Louise Slaughter. Well, today you're about to hear from Congressman Tom Reed. Before we get to Tom Reed, I do want to bring in my news director, and that's Randy Gorbman from WXXI in the newsroom, because as much as we'd like to say it's over, it's not quite over yet.
Still have some room to go.
We got some room to go.
We'd like to finish it today if we can. Finish it earlier than the
Our
weekend, certainly.
Our pledge drive, yes.
Our pledge drive. This is something we do just a few times a year. I know some public radio stations around the country do more intrusive and lengthier pledge drives. We try to keep this to a minimum, but we do need your support. We would like to end it today, so you can go online, either WXXI.org or WEOS.org as well, and make your contribution, show the support for the kind of great programming you hear all day long on WXXI, and of course, Connections, very important part of that. I know last hour, Evan, you had a really interesting discussion on the importance of play and recess. This hour, very closely watched race in the Southern Tier, Congressman Reed running for re-election against Martha Roberts. And, of course, the second half hour, we had that one school budget that went down in defeat yesterday. Didn't quite meet the supermajority they needed with Jeff Crane of West Irondequoit talking about that. Very important issues, and you're not going to hear that kind of in-depth discussion on any other radio program, I don't think, today, certainly.
I think, having worked in news and various newsrooms over the course of my career, the one thing that I often heard for years was listeners or viewers, et cetera, who wanted a chance to hear more from their elected members of Congress at length. You know, we're used to seeing 10, 12-second mm-hmm. sound bites, but they're not used to seeing it at length, and this is something that we committed to, and the day that I was hired, you told me that we were committed to.
Yeah, and it's so, I mean, you know, I've worked in commercial radio for years, as you have worked in the commercial side too, and you know what the strains are in terms of having to do the sound bites. We don't like doing it, but we do them to fit in with that framework. But here, we have the luxury, and it's not really the luxury, I think it's the necessity these days.
Yes.
We have complex topics.
Indeed.
To devote to listening. I mean, whether you like or don't like a particular candidate, a representative, assemblyman, senator, whatever, it really really is only fair that you hear them out to some extent, hear what their positions are, not make your decision based on a 10 or 15 second soundbite. That's where this talk show, especially Connections, comes in. You get to hear these folks at length, and that's one of the things we're going to be doing today.
Thank you, Randy.
Okay.
Nice to see you as well. That's Randy Gorbman, the news director from WXXI, as we try to wrap up our pledge campaign. Do need your help. And again, he mentioned the websites, WXXI.org and WEOS.org. I will mention the phone number that you can call right now. It'll take you less than 2 minutes. 800-295-9994. 800-295-9994 to make a pledge. Again, it'll take you less than 2 minutes. Tom Reed is the member of Congress from the 23rd District of New York, a Republican, and, of course, running for re-election this year. We have been spending some time in recent weeks trying to track down not only Tom Reed, but other candidates for Congress, members of Congress. You're going to be hearing in the coming weeks from, we expect, Congresswoman Lou Slaughter will join us again. She joined us on the first day of this program. And, of course, today you might have heard our condolences along with really so many people who know her well of the passing of her husband, Bob Slaughter, at the age of 82. We're going to hope to hear from Congresswoman Louise Slaughter in the coming weeks. Once again, her opponent, likely to be Republican Mark Essini. We're going to be talking to him in the coming weeks as well. And Chris Collins, Dan Maffei, many other members of Congress and candidates. And it will be your chance to interact with them. In this case, with Congressman Tom Reed, his staff told us that his schedule precluded him from doing a live interview. That, unfortunately, it means that couldn't get any live listener calls at that moment. But I did have a chance to speak to him at length on a number of issues about the Affordable Care Act, what he would change and what he would keep about Obamacare, whether to raise the minimum wage, whether to attach it to inflation, how you address the minimum wage, how to create jobs in New York, especially in the Finger Lakes and the Southern Tier, and some of the issues that are very important to him as well. So this is our conversation with Congressman Tom Reed. We caught up to him when he was on the road talking to voters.
Well, today we're over in Ithaca. We had a roundtable with different individuals dealing with sexual assault and highlighting and spotlighting that issue in the district.
That is one I know that you have had your mind on lately. Why specifically? What's been going on?
Well, you know, one of the things, as I shared on the floor of the House, sexual assault became very personal to me about 2 years ago, a year and a half ago. My niece was raped here in the district, and from that experience, I wanted to use our office to highlight sexual assault and make sure that people are aware of it and do what we can legislatively and also as a public official to say no more, no more to sexual assault. It's time that we openly discuss it and come together to solve the problem, because it's just a horrific situation that really devastates so many different individuals when it occurs.
But it's always fair to ask legislatively if there is an impact that can be made outside of existing law. What do you see in existing law that's not doing enough when it comes to sexual assault?
Well, I think the first thing, before we get to the legal legislative process, is we just have to raise it to the forefront so that we change the culture of the issue. Today in the roundtable, an individual, a prosecutor, joined us and talked about, you know, when he first came in into the DA's office, that DWI was viewed much differently than the way it is viewed today. And we need to start there. We need to start with a cultural shift where sexual assault is not the, she was asking for it, or she must have said yes because she wore provocative clothes and things like that. Yeah, it's time for us to come together culturally and say, we're going to talk about it, we're going to teach the next generation that it's not appropriate to engage in that type of sexual violence, sexual assault, and really understand what healthy relationships are all about and empower victims as we go through this process. And that's on the legislative front. We heard some great input about making sure that as we deal with it legislatively, we do not lose sight of the people that we need to be standing for first and foremost are the victims, and making sure that they as individuals are empowered to control their destiny. And that's one of the inputs I will take back to me into Washington, D.C., is to make sure that you don't have a one-size-fits-all mentality, but that you utilize the ability to empower individuals to control their own healing process and investigations and be part of it in a way that's productive and goes a long way to empower them to take control of the situation as opposed to sometimes what we see today.
It's a personal issue for you because of what happened in your family. So it has immediacy, it has urgency for you. Will it have the same kind of urgency with your colleagues?
I hope so. And I'll tell you, we led a special order, which is an hour speech where we go down to the floor of the House and we can talk about any issue. And we took the special order about a month ago, and I invited all our colleagues down to the floor to discuss it from their perspective. And I was tell you, I was flabbergasted by the support. I saw Democrats, Republicans, 14 members come together to talk about this issue and say, you know what, no more. We had a judge who shared his experience with one case in particular where he talked about the incident and talked about how he sentenced the perpetrator to prison. But then the young lady who was the victim in that case had a lifetime of horror that ultimately led to her suicide. We had somebody talk from a military perspective of how this is in the military ranks. And it was just amazing to me how many people from across the country are impacted by this issue on a regular basis. And it highlighted to me and to my colleagues, I think, that, you know what, it is time to say no more. That's why we're joining the No More campaign and making sure that everyone knows it's just time to say no more to sexual assault and domestic violence in America.
Your colleague over on the Senate side, Senator Gillibrand, has talked about that on the military side of things. Any communication with her on proceeding going forward on this?
Yeah, we applaud Senator Gillibrand in regards to these efforts. I mean, she has been working tirelessly on making sure that sexual assault, especially in the military, is dealt with, that it's much more transparent and open. And we continue to work with her and support her in her efforts. And what we do want to do is take that platform and see if we can expand it even further. And that's where we're in discussions as to what we can do, colleagues both in the Senate and in the House, as to how we can legislatively work on a federal level to enhance this issue and highlight this issue and come up with real solutions that are going to say no more to sexual assault and domestic violence in America.
We're talking to Congressman Tom Reed, who has spent a lot of time talking with manufacturers in his district. And in some ways, if you live in the Rochester area, manufacturing, you tend to think of it either on a small scale or you think of it as sort of a 20 years ago thing with the big three, and obviously they're gone. Throughout your district, though, I know that you've been looking for input on how to help manufacturing going forward. What are you hearing, Tom?
Oh, I'll tell you, I'm excited about U.S. manufacturing. As you know, Evan, I co-sponsor, co-chair the U.S. Manufacturing Caucus in a bipartisan basis in the House of Representatives with a good friend of mine, Tim Ryan, from Ohio on the Democratic side. And what I'm hearing in the district is what I'm seeing across the nation, that U.S. manufacturing is on its way back. We are going to see a renaissance in U.S. manufacturing. And there's a whole slew of reasons why that is occurring. One, America's becoming a competitive market again in order to build things here and sell it abroad and sell it there. It's a belief I hold dearly. And one of the main reasons why that's occurring is, however you feel about the energy revolution with our natural gas and oil finds that are occurring in America, that resource in and of itself is making us much more competitive when it comes to utility costs, supply chains for our feedstocks that go into the industrial base that provides the U.S. manufacturing opportunity that we're talking about. And it has huge geopolitical implications too, also. But I'll tell you, manufacturers, I think, are in a prime position to capitalize on that renaissance and rebirth that that we're starting to see across the country.
Point to, give me a few examples, especially if listeners aren't familiar with some of the kinds of companies you're talking about.
Well, what I'm talking about, especially we have one bill in particular that the Revitalize American Manufacturing Innovation Act, RAMI, which I'm excited to be partnering with Joe Kennedy from Massachusetts on in a bipartisan way, and Sherry Brown and Roy Blunt in the Senate, both Democrat and Republican support there, to highlight the explosion in advanced manufacturing. Things like we're talking about with 3D printing in eastern Ohio. The stuff on the nanotech level that we're seeing out of University in Albany. Things I'm seeing right here in our backyard with photonics and advanced materials that are being produced that are creating a new technology, be it the flat screen TVs, be it GPS, be it exciting developments when it comes to technology that are happening right here in our backyard.
When it comes to looking ahead to this this election, you're in what Democrats say could be a competitive race. We shall see. But a lot of people are wondering if healthcare is going to be the single biggest issue. What do you think is going to be the biggest issue in your district as voters decide later this year?
Well, I think first and foremost, the overriding issue that I hear from people are about the economy and jobs, and what is the vision for going forward, and what I think both sides are going to offer. I believe in a strong private sector-based economy where we're building things, like we're talking about on U.S. manufacturing, where we're building things again and selling it there. That's the vision I have for America, and we're positioning ourselves with legislative policies and also just the empowering individuals with opportunities when it comes to workforce development and things like that. I think healthcare is going to be a big issue in the upcoming race across the country and also in our district in particular, because as I stood for repeal of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and continue to stand for repeal of it, I think more and more people are seeing that the implementation of it in particular is really having those consequences that are negative, that are making healthcare not affordable, that are making healthcare, you may have an insurance policy, but boy, you got a tremendous amount of out-of-pocket expenses and high deductibles in order to comply with the law. And it's a fundamental change where, they pass the law to figure out what's in it, and you're seeing things like that just aren't true. You could keep your doctor if you want it, and policies won't get canceled, yet we're seeing that across the district. So I think, that is going to be an issue that is part of the campaign as we go forward.
If you repealed, if the House or if this country repealed Obamacare, there would be people who, in a rather short amount of time, would be without insurance. And so the issue would be, what happens to the millions in that category? Are there parts of the Affordable Care Act that you would keep?
Well, I would say once we repeal it, I think there's an opportunity to immediately proceed with the areas of common agreement where there's broad bipartisan support, especially when it comes to health insurance, like pre-existing condition, allowing kids to stay on their policies to the age of 26. So you can have a situation where you put those broad health insurance reforms that we all agree should be part of the health insurance reform debate going forward immediately into place upon repeal of the law. Then we can move to the real conversation that needs to be had across America in an open, transparent way, is how are we going to come together to drive these health care costs in America down? Now, that's a whole conversation that we need to have as a country. And I highlight things like, getting away from a fee-for-service-based healthcare system, empowering people to explore hospice and palliative care as part of their end-of-life systems and healthcare decision-making processes. Those things, in my opinion, and having an honest conversation about tort reform. I'm a believer in tort reform and the need to rid the system of defensive medicine. Those are all pieces of the puzzle that need to be brought together, but we need to do it in an open, transparent, open debate across America where we're talking about the driving issue here, and that's the ever-increasing rising healthcare costs in America and how we're going to get the costs under control so then we can make health insurance and healthcare available to everyone.
Another big part of the debate across the country is on the minimum wage, and we've seen Democrats led by the White House talking about $10.10 for a federal minimum wage, up from $7.25 now. The Congressional Budget Office has said that if that happened, we would see, it's hard to know exactly what would happen. You could see 1 million jobs lost, and you could see close to no effect on jobs. They're putting the number essentially in the middle, 500,000 jobs lost. They're also saying that there would be hundreds of thousands of people who would be coming out of poverty as a result. So where do you stand on the federal minimum wage? Should it move at all?
You know, on the federal minimum wage, I've been open to having the debate as to does it need to be adjusted, because it hasn't been looked at for quite some time. And I understand that debate and the need for that debate. But I will say, you know, one thing that I've been supportive of in my entire career is the more that we can empower state governments, the government closer to people than the federal government, I think you have a better government in operation. And that's where I see things like, you know, what's right for New York may not be right for Iowa, may not be right for Minnesota. And let the individual states weigh in on this and let them understand or at least weigh in and say, you know what, maybe 10.10 is appropriate for Massachusetts, but you know what, maybe $9 or $8 is appropriate in South Dakota, North Dakota. Because I'm real sensitive. If you just use a one-size-fits-all approach that the federal minimum wage going to 10.10 and losing that 500,000 number of jobs that they're estimated to cause as a result of doing that, especially with an economic recovery that is tenuous at best, you know, I'm about creating jobs, not implementing policies that are going to take away jobs. And if you do that across the country, I think there's really limited I think there's clear indication that you're going to have a significant impact on jobs and job losses, and we don't support going that way. We want to increase jobs.
Leaders in your party have said that it's difficult for business owners because they don't know either what the taxation climate's going to be or what the minimum wage is going to be. So one way to establish certainty for business owners, according to some economists, would be to attach the minimum wage to inflation. Would you support that?
Yeah, I think that's a legitimate piece of the debate. Take it out of the hands of politicians, and once we agree onto a number, and maybe that's some common ground that could be explored if we ever get to the issue of a federal minimum wage, but at least at the state capitals, maybe that's the common ground to explore is to, you know, we talk about adjusting it based on inflationary calculation. To me, that might be a better way to do it because you take the politics out of it and you're letting individuals get more control in the sense of recognizing what's coming down the pipeline, people being able to plan, budget appropriately, especially from an employer point of view as to what those costs are going to be, because you can project out the inflationary impacts in a somewhat reasonable manner.
One other part I want to make sure I ask you about is a subject that has been very big on my show in recent weeks, and that is the cost of higher education and whether there should be more or less federal subsidy in education. And the reason that's come up is I think from Syracuse to Buffalo, there's five different higher education institutions that are more than $60,000 a year now. Now, granted, Forbes says more than 80% of students don't pay that full sticker price, but still some do. And even the students who don't are paying $35,000, $40,000 a year. That's a lot of loan debt in this country. And I don't know if there's any easy way to stop it other than saying there's no way it can continue to go up the cost of college on an annual basis the way it has. Do you view federal subsidy as responsible for the rising cost? Do you view it as a solution to the rising cost? Give me a sense for what you think.
Well, I think, Evan, you touched on something that we need to be having a conversation on, and it is what is the full sticker price for these college educations and their costs associated with them. And when I have a chance to talk to universities and presidents and college presidents, that's one of the conversations I start with. You know, they want to spend a lot of time talking about what the net cost to students is, but I want to get to what's driving the increase of cost 538% over the last 5 years going up. 538% is the report I just had across the desk that showed education costs going up that high. That's not sustainable, and it doesn't make college affordable. So that people like myself who are still paying off college loans or my law school loans, I got a 30-year mortgage on my head, essentially. You know, how can we get these costs under control? Now, there's a lot of different arguments or suggestions that the subsidies in the federal government have created a bubble in higher education. You know, I don't know if that's the case, but I do know that the only way we're going to tackle this issue is if we don't talk about the net cost. Primarily, we talk about, you know, why are salaries for college presidents, superintendents, why are they in the seven-figure-plus range for endowment and university endowment officers? You know, why are they these costs for personnel so staggeringly high? Why is the compliance cost on the college campuses so high? Why are we investing in essentially a lot of bells and whistles for students just because they think somehow if you have the best athletic facilities or things like that, that somehow you're going to get more students coming to the facilities? You know, let's talk about how we're going to deliver education. Let's talk about how we're going to provide a service that is going to have a return on its investment. And I think at this point in time, we're getting to the point where we're seeing more and more studies say going to college is not paying off like it did for generations before. And that's a shame, because I'm a firm believer in higher education. Education is the key to empowering the next generation to be able to take care of themselves. And we want to make sure we're spotlighting ways to contain those costs and increase them.
One more quick question, and then we'll let you go. I know you're tight on time. You mentioned education being so important in this country. Are you surprised to see how strong the reaction has been to the Common Core standards in this country?
I've been opposed to the Common Core standards, especially the implementation of what we see. The overall goal of more accountability and increasing the education standards in America, I think we all share that. But what I'm seeing with the Common Core standards is this one-size-fits-all approach that I'm opposed to in Washington, D.C., and remain opposed to it. You know, they think they can draw a curriculum that will work in inner-city New York the same way that it works in Corning, New York, Ithaca, New York, Jamestown, as well as in Bismarck. To me, we need to have the flexibility. We need to have those accountability measures put in place. But, again, I'm a firm believer in the local government. The government closest to the people governs best. And that's where we need to empower our teachers, our school boards, to be making these fundamental decisions. And then we ask them, you know, how would you suggest at the federal level, if we're going to weigh in on this issue, how do we hold you accountable to these standards? And let them draw up the standards and then hold them accountable to those standards, as opposed to a top-down, one-size-fits-all approach that I think the Common Core standards are going down the wrong path of.
We appreciate you taking the time to join us here on Connections, Tom. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks, Evan, for the opportunity. Take care now.
That's Congressman Tom Reed, a Republican from the 23rd District of New York, running for re-election this year, and had some questions online earlier this week and this morning whether we're going to have his opponent, Democrat Martha Robertson, join us on the program as well. And the answer, number one, is yes, we hope so. Last week, I got in touch with candidate Martha Robertson's office and asked about having her come on the program as well, opposite Tom Reed, to provide a little balance there, to hear from both candidates there. And they said they were interested, and that was that. I have not been able to get a word from them in about a week. And so if anybody knows where Martha Robertson is, you can let me know, or you can have her call me. That would be fine. It's just one of these strange situations where we're not making good contact. But the answer is yes. We do expect that Martha Robertson will join us, and we certainly hope so, to explore all of these issues and more. And we'll let you know when we can do that. Martha Robertson, by the way, is a member. Has been a member of the Tompkins County Legislature since 2002, chaired it from 2010 through 2013. So Democrat Martha Robertson is the opponent of Republican incumbent Tom Reed. So you just heard from Tom Reed. We're going to take a very, very short break. And when we come back, we're looking at the property tax cap, school budgets, your tax dollars, and the districts that voted yes and no yesterday. What does it mean for some of the few districts that voted no? We're going to explore what that means next on member-supported public radio. On the next Connections, it's Healthy Friday. My colleague Elisa Orlando hosts the show that focuses on improving our health. It's your chance to not only learn about health issues, but to join the conversation and speak directly to medical professionals. Healthy Friday with Elisa Orlando, coming up on the next Connections. It's actually tomorrow's Thursday. It's not Friday. Our engineer, Dave Campo, is hoping that tomorrow was Friday. It's actually Thursday tomorrow. So apologies there. Tomorrow on this program, we're talking net neutrality. And if you have questions about the future of the internet, we have someone from the New America Foundation joining us on the program. We're also going to talk to local professors who have been kind of following the issue, talking to their students about it, weighing in, offering their expertise. One local professor says that the net neutrality debate could be setting us up in the near future for a pay-as-you-go internet, essentially completely reworking the way our internet access is covered, paid for, and works. And he's concerned about that. Others have different views. So if you've got questions about net neutrality, tomorrow noon we answer those for you. That's tomorrow on Connections. Right now, my news director from WXXI News, Randy Gorman, is here. Hello, Randy.
And we are not neutral about wanting support for WXXI. How about that for a segue?
No neutrality.
No
neutrality.
And, you know, that is such an important topic. And I mean, sometimes, you know, your eyes kind of cross when you start hearing the buzzwords. But that really could affect how many of us receive our internet services in the future. And it really has to do with, again, whether certain companies, organizations, or people get preference in terms of the kind of speeds and access they get. And again, where can you listen to a discussion like that except here on public radio, not just during Evan's show on Connections? I know NPR and Morning Edition and All Things Considered has covered that as well. Just great programming all day long. And again, Evan, a great part of that now since January. But we need your support. It costs us money to buy the NPR programs. Evan wants a couple of bucks a week. I'm not really sure why, but he still demands some kind of a salary. And we do have to find a way to pay for all of that. We have a very, I think, very robust news department, a large news department for public radio these days, but one which we hopefully are using to very good stead this week. You heard the very long series or package, I should say, that Michelle Faust did on the ban the box argument about people who are felons, how they fill out job applications. You'll be seeing some of that as well during Need to Know Rochester with Let Me and Duty Hofer coming up on Thursday night, doing another segment on that. But all of that, it costs money, not just for the staff, but for the electricity, for the equipment. We're constantly upgrading our equipment, getting some new cameras. Things should look better, sound better. But to do that, it really depends on everyone making a contribution, which you can do online right now at WXXI.org. Or if you're new to us right now on WEOS, we now broadcast the Connection Show in the Geneva station as well. You can also go online at WEOS.org. And please be a part of what we're trying to do here. It's important. It's important to know what's going on. It's nice to be able to kind of noodle around the net and figure some things out. But it's so much nicer, I think, don't you think, Evan, to have people who we've kind of helped bring to the fore to discuss, like the gentleman you have on tomorrow talking about net neutrality, experts who you can, you know, weigh in, not only just take their word for it, but you can weigh in with your opinion. And you don't get to do that in a whole lot of venues these days.
Well, it's true. And I'm not to go too far on the pledge, and we're going to get back to the program in just a second. I do want to say that I study the best talk show hosts in the country, because if you want to improve, you study the best. And certainly there's the Terry Grosses and the Diane Reams and so many others. But I also am always curious to see what is happening at NPR local affiliates. San Francisco is one of the best talk shows in the country. It's called The Forum. Just outstanding. I love listening online to what they're doing. But what they're doing requires an enormous amount of resources. Charlotte's got a very interesting program. I could go on. But every one of those communities has those programs because they support it. And we don't have this program without the support of the community. And thankfully, for years, we've had it, but we need it more than ever now.
And let's face it, those are much bigger markets. We have some very dedicated public radio listeners and watchers here, but a smaller base of people. So we need everybody to step up. You don't have to spend more than you can afford, but at least spend something. If you listen to this kind of programming on a regular basis, support it. Be a part of it. We don't have big, long commercial breaks, but because of that, we have to find other ways to raise the money.
Thank you, Randy.
Okay.
Randy Gorman, the news director from WXXI News here. Now, some big news that's happening in just a couple of hours from now is that in West Irondequoit, the superintendent's going to sit down with a group of teachers and deliver the news that their jobs, teachers and staff, I should say, that 25 jobs could be cut in about a month. West Irondequoit, one of the few districts across the state whose budget did not pass yesterday. And the question put in front of many taxpayers and really in front of districts was, do you want to override the property tax cap? Quick little bit of history here. And if you vote on your school budgets, or even if you don't, you might understand the tax cap. The tax cap was put in place in 2011. And the state put it in place. Most of the last couple of years, it's been about 2%, a little more than 2% of an increase over the previous this year's spending. This year, looking at the rate of inflation, the property tax cap in New York State was 1.46%. What that meant was school districts around this country, around the state, when they put their budgets together, could not exceed 1.46% over the previous year unless they asked their voters for a supermajority. So you can ask for whatever you want, but if you go over 1.46%, you have to get at least 60% support. Well, only 3% of the districts in the state tried that. 97% of the school districts in New York State said they're not going to attempt to override the property tax cap. They kept it within 1.46% or lower. And just about every one of those districts passed their budgets. Another reason, though, that these districts might have been hesitant to do that is because the property tax rebate is in play here. And listen to this. Governor Cuomo and the legislature have added this enticement this year. Homeowners in school districts that stay under the property tax cap will get a rebate check. Essentially, it's viewed, according to the Democrat and Chronicle, as a state subsidy to keep taxes flat. So a district really had to be in tough times, or at least feel like they were in tough times, to ask voters to go beyond that. Brighton did. Brighton raised taxes beyond the tax cap, and they got 70%. So they got the supermajority to pass it. West Irondequoit asked voters to go beyond the property tax cap. They did not get 60%. They got 56% support, but that technically means that the budget did not pass. So what are they going to do next? Will they come down a little? The answer is no. We had a chance this morning to talk to Superintendent Jeff Crane of West Irondequoit. This conversation may be about one school district, but as you're about to hear, it is kind of a foretelling of events for many other districts that will be trying to override the cap in coming years. So let's listen. Jeff, I know there weren't that many districts around the state that tried to override the cap. And as you have said this morning already, you would have you had the majority. You just did not get the supermajority. What were your sentiments when the vote was coming in last night?
I was pleased with the number of votes, even though we have 22,000 residents. When you are able to pull 3,000 voters into the day's work of voting, that's a great number. However, at the same time, based on percentages and the governor's mandate on this issue, I was concerned throughout the day. I've been concerned about this possibility all along because, you know, there's a lot of misinformation out there about what this means.
Well, and from Long Island to New York City to the Finger Lakes to Rochester to Buffalo, there aren't a whole lot of districts that tried to override the cap. And if you were concerned, do you now view it as a mistake to have tried to do it?
Absolutely not. There's I believe the number is 23 out of 700 districts across the state tried to do this. I believe Brighton was very successful getting over 70%, if I remember correctly. And Brighton and West Irondequoit made the right decisions. We would make the same decision again, and in fact, last night in an emergency Board of Education meeting, we did make that same decision.
Which means that when you put another budget back up, I believe it's June 17th, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so we're a month away from doing that again, 4 weeks away, and it will be the exact same budget?
It will be the exact same budget.
Okay. There is some sentiment out there, and we heard earlier this week from Jody Siegel, the head of the Monroe County School Boards Association, her sentiment that voting turnout in May for these kind of votes is always low, 5-10%, and Jody believes that a lot of voters assume a budget is going to pass, and that if it doesn't, that there is a sense of emergency that people will then get out and vote in higher numbers and pass it. We did hear from some voters who feel the opposite, that when people are galvanized, that they may want to hold districts, in their words, more accountable or be tougher on districts.
Sure.
What do you expect now that we've seen voters not reach the threshold you needed? Do you expect which way do you think it goes 4 weeks from now?
I expect, based on the tradition of excellence that is the West Irondequoit Central School District and the support of this community throughout the years, the last time. And I hesitate to even say this, Evan, because our budget did not go down. Our budget did not reach the threshold set by the governor, but our budget did not go down. But the last time that a budget did go down in West Irondequoit, if I have my facts right, was 1983, early 80s. And so I believe that because of that long stretch of successful budget votes that many people who care about this district and understand why we've been able to accomplish the lowest tax levy increase average over the past 10 years, the lowest in Monroe County at 2.02 average over the past 10 years, Evan. I believe that they know that we have done everything we can to protect the taxpayer, the property taxpayer, and also, more importantly, to protect our kids from the kind of cuts that we will now have to do on June 18th if this budget goes down.
It is important to talk about possible consequences, and by putting the exact same budget out there, once again, you will need 60%.
That's correct.
And if you don't get it, you get 59.9 or less, then you are forced to go back to last year's spending level. And let's make sure people do understand the consequences. I think in general, when we talk about school budgets, we talk in nebulous terms about program
right.
cuts, et cetera, mm-hmm. staffing. But what's realistic? What really happens on June 18th if the budget doesn't get the supermajority?
Well, even before June 18th, right now, we are trying to project the 25 people in our district who have to have potential layoff notices based on last night's vote. And that is a projection based on what kind of programs we may have to cut. And the domino effect, especially in seniority for the teachers in that personnel arena. But the 25 people, we believe, to protect them for their, you know, personal and professional lives, they need to get a potential layoff letter as soon as we possibly can. So we're working very diligently on that right now, although we wish we didn't have to. And certainly if the vote gets to 60% plus on June 17th, we won't have to worry about that. So we're doing that now. And Evan, I'm going to answer this in a way that I hope you understand. I've set up a meeting for those members of our faculty and staff that would like to come to my meeting at 3:30 today at the Irondequoit High School Auditorium so that they can hear first what this means for us. But I will answer it this way. Other school districts, and mostly rural school districts, have already crossed this threshold, and they've been forced to cut non-mandated activities. So that ranges anywhere from AP courses to sports, to music. Some instances, they've had to cut kindergarten because not too many folks understand that kindergarten is a non-mandated activity. So I can only answer that out of respect for my faculty and staff, who I believe deserve to hear from me first directly at 3:30 today, and just say to you that this is what other schools have had to do. And we've talked in a variety of ways across the state as this situation has gotten worse about not only financial insolvency but educational insolvency, and that's what some of our rural schools have already suffered.
Without being too specific yet, and I know you can't be when it comes to those 25 positions, you want to deliver that news to people first, and
yep.
you're still, I think, operating under the, if not expectation, then fervent hope that on June 18th you don't have to do that.
Correct.
But one of the reasons I wanted to air this interview on our talk show this afternoon is because, yes, you're one district locally, but I think that this is a universal question if voters decide to vote down budgets, which is their right. The question becomes, how do you go through the process? So as much as you can, talk me through how you decide on 25 positions, how you evaluate, how you make those decisions about if you have to do it, you do it, and how you arrive at which positions those will be.
Well, thank goodness I have not had to do it in my 40 years of being an educator. I don't look forward to it. We've talked about the possibility in the past, and hopefully this exercise will be one that we don't have to implement. But my concept is keep as much pain away from the kids currently in the district for as long as possible. And that, quite frankly, Evan, is what we've done for 10 years. We've used our reserves to a point where if we use any more reserves, we will compromise the fiscal integrity of the district, and we are not going to do that. We have through attrition and other methods and layoffs up to this point, we have cut over the years over between 10 and 12% of our faculty, staff, and administration. All personnel areas have been affected equally by 10 to 12%. We have used our reserves to cover the gap elimination adjustment, which over the years, since Governor Patterson did that, we've lost over $12 million. And this year, although the governor and the legislature restored $500,000 of it, we still started the year $2 million in deficit. So it's not like this hasn't been in the back of our thoughts and a possibility since we've lost so much revenue. But my comment this morning, I'll say it to you again, we are the canary in the mine. If any school districts, and I, like I said, the rural schools have already addressed these issues and are in trouble around educational insolvency, and it's coming to the suburban schools, and we're the first one because we refused to meet a tax cap that would have caused us to cut $950,000. Instead, we went out at 3.9%, and for the 11th year in a row, we told people, we are not coming to you with a budget that has anything extra in it. This is exactly what we need to be able to provide the Western Iroquois education that this community has traditionally supported, and the education that people move to this community to attain for their kids. So that's one of the reasons that we have to go out with the exact same budget. We have no options left. The gap elimination adjustment has caught up to us. All of our strategies have been used. We've asked for the return of all of our gap elimination money. Evan, if they returned all $2 million, we wouldn't have to break the tax cap until 2021, I think it is, if we had just the money that they have taken away from us since Governor Patterson initiated that. So you keep the cuts away from programs and kids for as long as you can. And what the people in West Irondequoit are going to find out relatively soon, today probably, is that we have no other options. We are now at program. So now what do? Well, you have to go to non-mandated programs first. We have no choice. We can't cut mandated programs. So that limits you to the kinds of things you've seen other districts cut over the years when they get into this situation. And it's they are, like I said before, they range from AP courses and electives at the high school mostly to some portion of the sports programs. You know, what worries me the most, I'll tell you, is the co-curricular clubs. We have over 50 clubs between grades 4 and 12. And the clubs are important because they are one of the most important anti-bullying strategies we use throughout the district. These clubs give kids a place to go with other kids who like the kinds of things they like, with adults who like to assist kids in those things. And by cutting the stipends and all of those, we are going to restrict our anti-bullying strategies greatly. So, but you know it. By cutting those kinds of things, you stay away from the classroom as best you can. The cuts are going to increase class sizes automatically. There's no doubt about it. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but the thought process is something that we've gone through recently.
All right, a couple more quick questions on this, because you talk about the fact that in your view, this was the best you could do for taxpayers. You've spent a decade showing taxpayers that you're trying to be fiscally responsible, but you do have mandated costs. And we heard earlier this week from some listeners who said, you might not have control over those mandated costs, but shouldn't the educational system as a whole work to get pensions, benefits in order in a way that will stop constricting you so much?
Absolutely.
What do you think about that?
Absolutely. That's why many of us in positions like mine and school board members go to Albany to advocate at least two times a year, and to our local legislature members many times a year. I've had many conversations about this issue with our legislators, and the answer to the pension adjustments is the level 6 pension program that was instituted last year. Remember?
Tier
6. And that's as far as the legislature and the governor will go in helping us. Here's the problem. None of those people are in our district yet. They are all Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3, Tier 4, and those pension costs can't be changed without a constitutional amendment by the state legislature, and they're not going to do that. So that's something we've been lobbying for. But in our local negotiations, our unions understand this, and we've made adjustments in legacy costs around health care. We've made some great moves with our unions who know that some of the things that happened years ago are not sustainable, and we're working together to try and lessen the burden on the property taxpayer. And let's be clear about another thing, Evan. One of our folks out there makes it clear that we pay the highest taxes, second highest in Monroe County, to only East Irondequoit. There's a reason for that. We don't spend freely. We are under the median, of per pupil expenditures in Monroe County. We don't have a lot of businesses, and to offset the property taxpayers' burden, and that's what we've been cognizant of for years. That's why we've worked so hard to keep our own 2.02 tax cap over 10 years. So it is a complicated issue, but we do talk with our legislators often. We do have great collaboration with our unions about trying to make this a sustainable system where, in fact, it wasn't years ago.
Jody Siegel said that you look back at the 1960s or roughly thereabouts, teacher salaries were not necessarily all that competitive, and so benefits rose as a way to help make up for that.
And they were very inexpensive to give away.
Sure,
and
her point is that as teacher salaries have become more competitive, and again, we're not saying that teachers live lavish lives, but they don't live in poverty either. And Jody was saying that as teacher salaries have come up, benefits have stayed the same, and that maybe that's out of whack. And I don't want to mischaracterize her position, but is that a fair way to describe it?
No, and I think we could summarize that in, you know, where many educational employees used to get 100% health care, very, very, very few have 100% health care these days. And that's a way of adjusting that. You know, in this district, central office is paying 20%, similar to businesses out there, according to Sandy Parker when I talked with her last. And our teachers and our clerical staff are all paying more and more of their health care. And that's what I was sort of talking about when I talked about, you know, collaborative negotiations with folks who understand that systems of the past were unsustainable, and we've got to help work together to help the property taxpayer exist in our towns.
Want to wrap up with a question that kind of mirrors what we heard from some of our more conservative listeners earlier this week. They hear you say that you put the budget out there asking for the supermajority because you felt that was your only option. They may say, look, most other districts didn't feel that it was their only option, and that you do have an option to go somewhere underneath that cap, and you chose not to. How would you respond to the voter who says, look, show me why you couldn't do what most other districts did?
Well, because we have used different strategies over the past 10 years to keep our tax cap lower than anyone else's. And because we're out of the reserves, we now have to go to the cuts. And when people see what the $950,000 of cuts that we would have had to make for yesterday's vote to meet our cap, they will better understand why we didn't do it. But there's a general feeling amongst some of your more conservative community members that there's always fat in the school budget. And we have sent out, we have been transparent. We have cut our budget-to-budget increases over the course of 10 years, all the way to last year where we were the only district that cut the budget. This will tell you something, Evan. If you're only increasing your budget by 1.8% budget-to-budget and you have to go out at a 3.9% tax levy, does that not tell you that outside variables are affecting us in a way that we can't control? We can't without taxpayer help restore the gap elimination money. We can't accelerate our technology program to meet the mandate of computerized testing without taxpayers helping us, because we have spent our reserves down to protect the taxpayer for 10 years. We have no choice left to us. So I hope that answers your question. Yeah. We've avoided this choice for 10 years. We've kept it at 2.02 average over 10 years. And I'm hoping that the trust that we've built up with our community over those 10 years will be shown at a different ratio on June 17th.
I haven't seen the statewide numbers in terms of turnout. Do you know what your percentage eligible voter turnout was yesterday, Jeff?
All I know is that we have 22,000 residents and 3,000 voters.
What do you expect 4 weeks from now when you put the same budget back out there?
I will expect that the conservative folks who say, how arrogant of you not to change that, will come out in a little bit higher number. And I'm hoping that the folks who have come to know the quality of education in West Irondequoit will come out in much greater numbers.
That's Jeff Crane, the superintendent of West Irondequoit Schools, whose budget did not pass yesterday, even though it got 56% support from voters. It needed 60% and a supermajority as the district tried to override the property tax cap. Looking around the state, by the way, look downstate. Here's an example. All 53 school budgets passed in Westchester, Rockland, Putnam counties. Most of those budgets passed by 3-1 or 4-1 ratios. None of those districts tried to override the property tax cap. Though here is a quote that lines up with what you just heard from Superintendent Jeff Crane of West Irondequoit. This comes from Lisa Davis, the executive director of the Westchester-Putnam School Boards Association. She said, quote, unless there is legislation to address mandated school district expenditures, districts will need to go for an override in the near future in order to maintain the quality of their educational program, end quote. So what she is saying is exactly what Jeff Crane is saying today, which is that, yes, only West Irondequoit and Brighton in our area tried to override the property tax cap this year, but expect that list to grow next year, the year after, if things don't change. Whether or not that's true, we shall see. West Irondequoit votes again on June 17th. They will have a chance to vote on the exact same budget. And this afternoon, about 90 minutes from now, the superintendent will meet with the staff who could be losing their jobs as a result of that budget vote. We'll keep you up to date on that, and we appreciate your listening to Connections today. I'm Evan Dawson. Our thanks to our engineer, Dave Campo, our news director, Randy Gorman, who's been joining us, helping us try to push us over the top in this pledge drive. And you can jump on WXXI.org or WEOS.org as we try to finish off the pledge drive and get back to full hour programming, the fewest interruptions of any radio content that you'll find. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great day, and we'll talk to you on Thursday.